Hello, friends. Welcome back to Love Will Tear Us Apart, a podcast on your favorite complicated couples. In this episode, I will explore a couple that wasn't very complicated at all. In fact, they were in a perfectly happy and healthy relationship. They had an enviable love story. I'd been wanting to share their story for some time, and now seemed like a good one. The couple is Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Martin Ginsburg. I'm writing this intro 3 hours after hearing the news that Justice Ginsburg had passed away. Like many of you, I'm devastated. I've spent the past 3 hours in a daze, and I thought bumping up their love story might help me work through some of these emotions. I first became interested in their relationship when I heard an NPR story where Ruth read the letter her husband wrote to her before he passed away in 2010. I'll save the letter for later in the podcast, but it's quite moving. Shortly thereafter, I watched the documentary RBG, which shed a little more light on their remarkable relationship. While this podcast tends to focus more on tragic or hot mess relationships, hence the name Love Will Tear Us Apart, at its core, it's a podcast about epic relationships. And Ruth and Martin's relationship was epic. So without further ado, here is the love story of Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Martin Ginsburg. Joan Ruth Kiki Bader was born in Brooklyn, New York on March 15, 1933, to two Jewish parents. Celia, who was born in America 4 months after her parents arrived from Austria, and Nathan, who came to America from Russia at the age of 13 and later became a manufacturer of fur. Ruth had an older sister, Marilyn, who passed away from meningitis at the age of 6. Ruth looked up to her mother, whom she felt was very smart but played the dutiful wife and mother roles, and it was her mother who instructed her daughter to be independent. Ruth attended public school 238 in Brooklyn, the same school Bernie Sanders and Chuck Schumer attended, and James Madison High School, where her future husband also went to high school. Like Ruth, many students at the school were children of immigrants. Reading was a very important pastime in her home. She was a fan of the Nancy Drew books because Nancy had an independent spirit. And Ruth was both musical and athletic. In fact, she was one of the top students in her class. Unfortunately, Celia developed cancer during Ruth's high school years and died 2 days before her daughter's graduation, causing Ruth to miss the event. Due to her excellent grades, Ruth received a full scholarship to Cornell. One of her professors there was Lolita author Vladimir Nabokov, and she credits him to changing the way she reads and writes. During her second year at Cornell, Ruth was inspired to become a lawyer after watching the lawyers stand up for Americans who were blacklisted during the McCarthy hearings. She said, "And from those transcripts, I saw that there were lawyers standing up for these people, reminding our Congress that we have a First Amendment guaranteeing free speech, and we have a Fifth Amendment guaranteeing against self-incrimination. So I thought that that was a pretty good thing to do, that a lawyer could have a professional career, could have a paid job, and volunteer services in bad times to help make things a little better. That's when I had the idea that I would like to be a lawyer." It was at Cornell that she would meet Martin, or Marty, Ginsburg, a fellow Jewish public school kid from Brooklyn. Martin David Ginsburg was born on June 10th, 1932, in Brooklyn, New York, to Evelyn and Morris Ginsburg, the vice president of a department store chain. Like his future bride, Marty attended James Madison High School, though I don't think they knew each other at the time. In 1950, Marty's Cornell roommate set him up on a blind date with 18-year-old Ruth, whom he thought was, quote, awfully cute. However, he quickly realized that she was brilliant, too, and that deeply attracted him to her. On the flip side, Ruth was also attracted to Marty. She loved that he respected her intelligence. Though personality-wise, they were very different. Ruth was shy and Marty was life of the party. The two became inseparable, and upon her graduation from Cornell in 1954, the young 20-somethings married. They briefly moved to Oklahoma, where Marty completed his ROTC service. While Ruth worked at the Social Security office in Oklahoma, she was demoted for becoming pregnant with their first child, a daughter named Jane, born in 1955. Also during this time, Marty realized Ruth couldn't cook to save her life, and he became the meal preparer in the family. The two motivated intellectuals didn't let family life slow them down. Marty enrolled at Harvard Law School, and Ruth enrolled a year later. At Harvard, Ruth was one of only 9 women in her class. And at the time, women made up less than 3% of the legal profession. There were over 500 men in her class, and she regularly faced misogynistic comments from her peers. It was also during this time that Marty was diagnosed with testicular cancer and given only a 5% chance of survival. Just imagine, Ruth was a young mother tending to a sick husband while obtaining her law degree in a male-dominated field. And just imagine Marty, who was going through rigorous cancer treatment and was still studying law with his wife every day between bouts of sleeping. Fortunately, Marty's cancer went into remission and he graduated cum laude from Harvard. He joined a law firm in New York City, and Ruth transferred to Columbia Law School. She would be the first woman to write for the Harvard Law Review and the Columbia Law Review at the same time. Marty often proudly mentioned that he was rejected from the Harvard Law Review. However, upon graduation, Ruth wasn't as lucky to find a job as a lawyer. In fact, she often had doors shut in her face. No one wanted to hire a young mother in their law office or court. She said, "I was Jewish, a woman, and a mother." The first raised one eyebrow, the second two. The third made me indubitably inadmissible. Ruth finally landed a clerkship for Judge Edmund Palmieri in New York City. After 2 years there, she learned Swedish and co-authored a book on international procedure. Let me say that again. She learned Swedish. She really kind of was a Wonder Woman, wasn't she? So then she got a teaching job at Rutgers Law School and later a tenure professorship at Columbia, the first woman to do so. In 1965, she and Marty welcomed their second child, a son named James. Ruth had to hide her pregnancy from the school. Marty, too, was teaching at the time. He was adjunct faculty at New York University Law School and was a visiting professor at several prestigious law schools throughout the remainder of his life. His specialty was taxation law. Ruth has said that when one partner had a heavier workload, the other partner picked up the household duties. Throughout their relationship, those duties swapped back and forth without fuss. Marty was perfectly fine cooking and taking care of the house when Ruth needed him to, and vice versa. Ruth said, "In the course of a marriage, one accommodates the other. So, for example, when Marty was intent on becoming a partner in a New York law firm in 5 years, during that time, I was the major caretaker of our home and child. But when I started up the ACLU Women's Rights Project, Marty realized how important that work was." The 70s were a busy decade for the Ginsburgs. This is the decade that the couple would represent Charles Moritz, a spouseless man who took care of his mother and was denied a caregiver deduction by the IRS based on his gender. He represented himself in court in hopes of reversing the decision without luck. Marty showed the case to Ruth, and the couple decided to take it on. With the help of a friend from the ACLU, they brought the case to the 10th Circuit. Marty argued the tax part, and Ruth argued the protections part, and they won. This would be the first in many gender-related cases Ruth would represent, and she would rep 6 gender discrimination cases, both for men and women, before the Supreme Court, all while she was director of the ACLU's Women's Rights Project. This prolific time in Ruth's life is what has earned her the reputation of being a fierce advocate for women's rights and civil rights. In 1980, Ruth was nominated by President Carter for the United States Court of Appeals in D.C., and she was confirmed by the Senate. By 1993, when Ruth was 60 years old, she was nominated by President Bill Clinton to fill a vacancy on the Supreme Court. Ruth had been low on Clinton's list of potential picks. But Marty had spent countless days reaching out to women's groups, who were not a huge fan of Ruth at the time because she was critical of Roe versus Wade. And he also reached out to important figures in politics and law. Finally, President Clinton decided to meet with her, and he knew within 15 minutes she was his choice. Only 3 senators voted against her appointment. Ruth would be the second woman to serve on the court, the first being Sandra Day O'Connor, and she was the first Jewish woman. Ruth was very frank about the fact that she didn't believe she would have gotten the position without the help of her husband. It's not because she wasn't qualified. It's because she wasn't as good of a cheerleader for herself as her husband was. 6 years after Marty's death, in 2016, she wrote in the New York Times, "I've had more than a little bit of luck in life, but nothing equals in magnitude my marriage to Martin D. Ginsburg. I do not have words adequate to describe my super smart, exuberant, ever-loving spouse. Marty coached me through the birth of our son. He was the first reader and critic of articles, speeches, and briefs I drafted. And he was at my side constantly, in and out of the hospital, during 2 long bouts with cancer. And I betray no secret in reporting that, without him, I would not have gained a seat on the Supreme Court." At Ruth's Supreme Court confirmation, she said in her speech, "I have had the great good fortune to share life with a partner truly extraordinary for his generation, a man who believed at age 18 when we met, and who believes today that a woman's work, whether at home or on the job, is as important as a man's. As for Marty," he said around that time, "I've been supportive of my wife since the beginning of time, and she has been supportive of me. It's not sacrifice, it's family." As a justice, Ruth began to shift more to the left, and over the years, she became a hero to many on the left. Her poise, intellect, graciousness, and fairness ingratiated her to people on both sides of the aisle. In fact, she became very close to one of the most conservative justices on the bench, Antonin Scalia. Their unlikely friendship has often been heralded as an example of how people on different sides of the aisle can still find common ground. The two would often attend the opera together, and their families would often dine together. Some of Ruth's most iconic rulings during her time on the bench include getting the last all-male public undergraduate college, Virginia Military Institute, to admit women. She helped legalize gay marriage. She helped pave the way for the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act. She dissented on overturning the Voting Rights Act. And she dissented on the banning of the Florida votes recount during the Bush versus Gore election. During Ruth's first 15-plus years on the Supreme Court bench, Marty continued to teach and acted as counsel for a firm in D.C. One of his biggest clients was Ross Perot, who he later became friends with. While life was pretty even-keel for the Ginsburgs, Ruth had several health setbacks. In 1999, she was diagnosed with colorectal cancer and then pancreatic cancer in 2009. Through it all, Marty was by her side. When asked by her friend, NPR's Nina Totenberg, about her cancer treatments and missing the support of her husband after he passed away, this is what Ruth said. "He stayed with me in the hospital, sleeping on an uncomfortable couch despite his bad back. And I knew that someone was there who really cared about me and would make sure that things didn't go wrong. There was one day during the colon cancer bout when I was getting a blood transfusion and Marty saw that something was very wrong and he immediately yanked the needle out of me. It turned out there was a mismatch, not in the type of blood, but some antigen. I might not have lived if he hadn't been there. And he would encourage me when they sent a physical therapist to get me to walk and to do whatever exercise regime they had. I didn't want to do it. I was exhausted, and Marty said, 'You do it!' And he was quite insistent about that. So to have his loving care and his determination that I would do what was necessary to heal faster, it was hard to be alone. As soon as I came home and to eat again, he made wonderful meals for me. We walked around Georgetown. We walked to the Phillips Collection. We did some of my favorite things. Marty had a wonderful sense of humor. He was my clipping service for the New York Times and the Post. I miss him every morning because I have no one to go through the paper and pick out what I should read." While Ruth would beat both the colorectal cancer and pancreatic cancer, her dear Marty wasn't as lucky. In 2010, Marty, too, was diagnosed with cancer. While I wasn't able to find the exact length of his illness, I believe it was a short one. Marty died of metastatic cancer at their home, 4 days after he and Ruth celebrated their 56th wedding anniversary. The constant professional that she was, Ruth appeared on the court the day after Marty's death to announce her opinion for a case. She said to her fellow justices, "Marty would have wanted it this way." Ruth always kept herself busy thinking and working, and continuing work probably helped her handle this overwhelming loss. Ruth lost the person she called her best friend. In a 2016 NPR interview, Ruth shared a letter she had found in the stand next to Marty's hospital bed and read it out loud. You can listen to the clip on NPR. I'm going to warn you, you're probably going to need to pull out the tissues. Ruth keeps her demeanor throughout, but you hear her voice crack at the very end. And I'm going to try to not lose my shit while I read this letter. This is what she said in the interview. I found this letter in the drawer of the stand next to Marty's bed in the hospital. When we knew it was the end, and I was taking him home so that he could die at home rather than in the hospital. I was checking to see that we had everything he brought with him. And on a yellow pad, there was a letter to me. And it reads, "My dearest Ruth, you are the only person I have loved in my life, setting aside a bit parents and kids and their kids. And I've admired and loved you almost since the day we first met at Cornell some 56 years ago." And then she says, "He was wrong about 56. It was nearly 60 years ago. We were married for 56 years. So she continues, "What a treat it has been to watch you progress to the very top of the legal world. I will be in John Hopkins Medical Center until Friday, June 25th, I believe. And between then and now, I shall think hard on my remaining health and life and consider, on balance, the time has come for me to tough it out or to take leave of life, because the loss of quality now simply overwhelms. I hope you will support me where I come out, but I understand you may not. I will not love you a jot less. Marty." For the next 10 years after Marty's death, Ruth kept busy at her job, ruling and dissenting on some of the most important cases of our times. She enjoyed going to the opera and doing the occasional public appearance or speech. It was also during this time that she earned the nickname, the Notorious RBG. 2018 was a big year for Ruth. A documentary called RBG was released, as was the narrative film On the Basis of Sex, which focuses on the early years of Ruth's career and family life. 2018 is also the year she'd be diagnosed with her third cancer, this time in her lungs, and it would be the first time she'd miss an oral argument in her entire career as a justice. The following year, she was diagnosed with cancer of her pancreas. Throughout this time, Ruth continued to work, and it truly seemed like nothing would ever stop her. She was in her mid-80s, but her physical and mental states were still strong. But in 2020, the cancer returned. In July, she released a statement saying, "I have often said I would remain a member of the court as long as I can do the job full steam. I remain fully able to do that." And that was the last we heard about her until September 18th, 2020. I'll be honest. I thought Ruth Bader Ginsburg was going to live forever. That little Jewish gal from Brooklyn had the strength of 1,000 men. That's why when I saw the news that she had passed away, I was stunned. And the gravity didn't hit me until a few days later. As I write this, it is 2 days after her death, and I feel remarkably more sad. Like her Marty, Ruth died of metastatic cancer at her home with her family by her side. She died on the first night of Rosh Hashanah, and there is a quote going around from a rabbi saying that someone who dies at the end of the Jewish year is a very righteous person. A statement from Ruth, dictated to her granddaughter before she died, said that her most fervent wish is that she will not be replaced until a new president is installed. Americans deeply mourned her passing, and they also donated over $80 million to Democratic causes and candidates in the first 24 hours after her death. Ruth will be the second woman to lie in the Capitol. The first woman was Rosa Parks. She'll be the first Jewish person to lie in state. If there is an afterlife, Ruth and Marty are now together. I've tried to not get overly sentimental about their relationship, but from everything I've read, they seemed like a pretty remarkable couple. Did they have their squabbles? I'm guessing so, but they had at their core a deep, deep respect for one another. A respect that kept their own egos and insecurities in check and allowed their relationship to become indestructible. May we all learn a little from Ruth and Marty, and may we all be as lucky to have a relationship like theirs. This episode was researched, written, and recorded by me, Lauren Modry. It was edited by Jonathan Luna. Mike G created the theme song. And please leave a review wherever you leave reviews.